This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the pernicious practice called death by incarceration that one in seven American prisoners face.
We speak with Valerie Kabbala, Communications Director for Straight Ahead, about how she helped organize several human rights groups to file a complaint with the UN asking them to condemn this horrific and illegal practice.
A recent investigation by the Electronic Frontier Foundation reveals how local police departments are paying thousands of dollars annually for our geolocation data. And that data goes back years.
We speak with Bennett Cyphers, who details for us the illegal practice of police gathering our data from our cell phones and laptops.
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. The United States condemns one out of every seven prisoners, or more than 200,000 people, over two-thirds of them people of color, to die in prison. Death by incarceration, or DBI, includes extreme sentences such as life and life without possibility of parole. Death by incarceration violates two treaties the U.S. has ratified, the Convention Against Torture and the Race Convention. Death by incarceration is the devastating consequence of a cruel and racially discriminatory criminal legal system that is designed not to address harm, violence, and its root causes, but to satisfy the political pressure to be tough on crime, according to a complaint filed with United Nations Special Rapporteurs on September 15th. Valerie Kabbala helped bring together organizations including the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Drop LWAP Coalition, and the Abolitionist Law Center to file the 31-page complaint. Valerie is a writer, organizer, and artist. She is the communications director for Straight Ahead, a nonprofit lobbying organization fighting for the human rights and liberation of incarcerated people. Valerie previously worked as an editorial manager and staff writer for Solidarity Watch. Valerie previously worked as an editorial manager and staff writer for Solitary Watch, a nonprofit organization documenting and exposing the use of solitary confinement across the United States. Her work has appeared in The Root, The Appeal, Truthout, The Chicago Reporter, and Shadowproof. We are lucky to have Valerie Kabbala with us today on Law and Disorder to discuss this groundbreaking complaint calling for the abolition of death by incarceration. Valerie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you giving me the time to be here.
What groups came together to file this complaint with the United Nations Special Rapporteurs, and to which rapporteurs is the complaint addressed?
So the groups that wrote the letter are the Abolitionist Law Center, the Amistad Law Project, the Center for Constitutional Rights, California Coalition for Women Prisoners, the Drexel University Community Lawyering Clinic, the Drop LWAP Coalition out of California, and the Release Aging People in Prisons out of New York. And there's a number of other organizations that also signed on to the letter as additional signatories. The letter is addressed to Tendai Achume, who is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance, Dr. Alice Jill Edwards, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, Claudia Mahler, who is the independent expert on the human rights of older prisoners, as well as the working group of experts on people of African descent, and the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention.
Val, can you please explain what death by incarceration, or DBI, is?
Absolutely. So death by incarceration is another way of saying a life sentence in prison. And we termed it death by incarceration because you're sentenced to death. It's another form of, in my opinion, the death penalty. It's just a slower method of killing somebody. You sentence them to death, and they don't have an end date, but whenever they die, they're supposed to still be incarcerated. So it's the devastating consequence of a racially discriminatory sentencing scheme that throws people away forever and doesn't give them a chance to ever come back to society and live freely.
Why does death by incarceration disproportionately affect people of color, women, youth, the elderly, and people with disabilities?
So this country is still mired in its racist, sexist, ableist, ageist, and classist structures that have existed since its inception. The 13th Amendment did not abolish slavery, it just shifted it into the prison system. And so for the most part, at every point of our policing and criminal legal system, the injustices fall most heavily on Black people, Indigenous people, Latinx people, LGBTQIA people, women, youth, physically and psychiatrically disabled people, poor people, and our elders. And with specifically death by incarceration, targeting non-male, non-white, non-wealthy populations is for several and different reasons. Black people are disproportionately locked up, period, in this country. But I think felony murder can illustrate well why specifically Black people and women are most targeted by the mandatory sentences to die in prison. Felony murder is a statute that expands the definition of murder to include anyone who is deemed present and associated with a felony crime in which a person dies. So, for example, if a group of kids, they go out at night and they just go for a drive and they go to a pizza spot, you know, and all of a sudden things just start to escalate and someone decides, oh, let's rob a store, and they go along with it, and they go into the store and it doesn't go well, and all of a sudden someone pulls out a gun. The other people didn't even know the person had a gun, and someone dies. All of those people, all of those kids are facing a mandatory sentence to die in prison, in Pennsylvania anyway. And you can see how sentencing schemes like this affect Black people more because they still face the generational trauma of slavery in their everyday lives. Their parents are more likely to be locked up. They're more likely to look to the streets for love and support. They're more likely to be poor and out looking for money. And so in Pennsylvania, 1,100 of the people who are sentenced to life without parole are facing that sentence for a situation similar to what I just described, for felony murder. And of those, 70% are Black. Felony murder also illustrates why women face disproportionate sentences of death by incarceration because of the patriarchal abuse that women are systematically subjected to. I've read so many cases of women who were there but didn't commit the crime. So there was one woman who was with her pimp and he killed somebody and she got life for that. Another woman, she was actually 14 and when her abusive 21-year-old boyfriend came and killed her mom, she got locked up for life. Another woman went to a drug spot with her controlling abusive boyfriend and he pulled the trigger during a robbery. And all of these women were in a situation where they were being abused by a man and the man roped them into a situation in which a person died. And then the woman's life is taken away by incarceration. Another reason that it affects women disproportionately is because when women fight back against that patriarchal abuse, we're criminalized for it. So if a woman is in an abusive, violent relationship or situation at home and she fights back and the person dies, she gets life. In regards to youth, studies have widely shown that our brain development continues until our mid-20s. And so young people often will, you know, make more rash decisions, more impulsive decisions, and decisions that they aren't thinking about the consequences for. They're not thinking that they'll be locked up for life. And then something happens, something escalates, they make a mistake, and all of a sudden, they're sentenced to die in prison. And we see the numbers show that most of the people sentenced to death by incarceration committed their crime in their 20s or earlier. But it affects our elders because of aging in prison. If you're sentenced to life in prison, that's your whole life. And we don't really think about what that process looks like when we're aging in prison. Our population is getting older and older in prison, and they're facing more and more medical issues, psychological issues, because of these sentences and because of the torturous conditions in prison and the lack of medical care and the torture of practices like solitary confinement. In Pennsylvania, 10,000 people who are locked up in our prisons are over 50 years old. And that's the age that you're considered geriatric to the prison system, because your life expectancy is so much shorter because of the conditions that I just mentioned. So 10,000 of people in our prison system in PA are geriatric, and they're not getting the care that they need.
That strikes me as especially compelling, and in a negative way, given that when someone is accused of a death-eligible crime, one that will be punished potentially by death, jurors are asked to weigh both mitigating and aggravating circumstances and to take that into consideration when they decide on their penalty. But that contrasts with what you've just explained, where, for example, a woman may be under the pressure of her pimp in the same car, but those factors, unless I'm wrong, are not given consideration in her sentencing to perhaps give her a far lesser sentence because she really couldn't exercise autonomy, being that she was under the control of her pimp in a car and didn't know what was going to happen. We're wondering, what would you say are the root causes, if there are, of DBI?
So I would say what leads people into situations in which they are facing such a harsh sentence as death by incarceration is a combination of the systemic deprivation of basic human resources like education, healthcare, food, things like poverty and housing insecurity, violence at home. These are the things that lead people into such situations. And at the same time, in our political system, there's this heavy-handed, tough-on-crime mentality that has persisted for decades as an extension of slavery mentality that throws people away and devalues certain types of people, the types of people that we're talking about, Black people, women, youth, elders, disabled people. That's how we got to this place with this draconian sentencing scheme.
Val, how prevalent is death by incarceration in the United States? Is it on the rise? And why, if so, why do you think it is?
It's sadly extremely prevalent. Before mass incarceration took hold of the United States in the 70s, the number of people in prison overall was less than 200,000. Today, it's, depending on where you get your numbers, I'm taking this from a sentencing report, and they cited 1.4 million. I think that's not including jails and immigrant detention centers. But of that 1.4 million, more than 200,000 people are serving life sentences. That's one out of every seven people in prison. That's an enormous amount of people. And the United States is a global outlier in the use of life without parole. In the U.S., it's more than 80% of those serving an LWOP sentence in the world. DBI has been on the rise since mass incarceration, and I would say it's because of the increase of that mentality, that tough on crime mentality, and the increase of fascism, really, in our political system, and racism and sexism. And so it's being doled out. This sentence continues to be doled out at extremely high rates.
Val, what international human rights does DBI violate?
So death by incarceration is disproportionate imposition on racial minorities, which violates the prohibition against racial discrimination. It violates an individual's right to life by stripping them of the rest of their entire life and sentencing them to die in a prison. It deprives people of their right to hope and to rehabilitation. The purpose of prison in the eyes of the United Nations is ultimately supposed to be rehabilitation, and death by incarceration strips that right completely in violation of the prohibition against torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. It violates an individual's right to family life, completely separating people from their families for the rest of their lives, preventing them from building a family, from having kids, from falling in love. It deprives them of liberty, and it serves no legitimate purpose, because people do change and people do rehabilitate themselves, often not because of, no thanks to the prison system itself, but thanks to the strength of these individuals who find accountability and change within themselves.
We're speaking today with Valerie Kabbala, Communications Director for Straight Ahead, about the complaint filed by several human rights organizations on September 15th, urging the UN to condemn death by incarceration and call for its abolition. Val, please explain the failures of clemency and parole in the United States, if you will.
I think the biggest failure is that it barely exists. In Pennsylvania, for example, after a few political situations in the late 70s, early 80s, early 90s, basically the whole commutation process was changed, making it nearly impossible for people to get commutation. It used to be, so people have to go to the Board of Pardons in order to be voted on whether they deserve commutation. And it used to be that you need a majority of that board, and it's now you need a unanimous vote. And there's no criteria. It's completely up to the discretion of the board. And so, for example, a gentleman that I know and I'm really close with, who is instrumental in the movement for liberation and to end death by incarceration and for human rights of incarcerated people, he's been serving his death by incarceration sentence for decades. And this man is a mentor to me. He has turned me on to so many books. He taught me about about how generational trauma is the root of the cause and the cause of this system, ultimately, of mass incarceration. He's taught me so much, and he's uplifted so many people within the prison system. His name is David Dawood Lee. He recently went up for commutation, and on paper, this man should have been approved with flying colors, but there was one person on the board who had a problem with him, and he said his reason was that he seemed too virtuous and that he didn't trust that that was his authentic self. And despite the people in the room where, when a question was asked, you know, should we trust him, people, the superintendent of the prison himself said, I've known this man for a decade and this is who he is. He's actually just a really good man. The psychologist on the board of pardon still voted against him. And it's situations like that where it's like, so what are you supposed to do? How can you change anything in order to get approved? There needs to be a set of criteria. There needs to be people on the board who actually know the people who are coming up for commutation and parole. They need to look at people's rehabilitation. Right now, often, they just bring up the crime that happened decades ago, sometimes 30, 40, 50 years ago. And that doesn't define a person. They need to look at the whole person. And so I would say the failure is that they're, it's not properly examining the whole person. And people deserve a second chance.
Val, testimonials from how many current and former inmates sentenced to DBI are included with the complaint? And might you read highlights from some of those testimonials for us?
Absolutely. So I believe it's 43 testimonies that we included across the country. It's hard to choose which ones, but I will choose a few. So this is an excerpt from Rose Dinkins, who is now 74 years old. She's been incarcerated for 50 years. And she said, I believe laws should be passed to abolish DBI sentences because it implies that people are not capable of change. It diminishes our relationships with family. When I was arrested, my four children were toddlers. Now they're in their 50s, with children and grandchildren of their own. I have great-grandchildren. I have never seen who I've never seen. DBI sentences condemn individuals for life based on one mistake, one exercise of poor judgment, one horrible day that seals their fate no matter how many certificates or degrees they earn. DBI sentences make us strangers to our family no matter how hard we try to stay in touch. These sentences provide no relief for reformed individuals. The justice system is meant to deter crime, to rehabilitate violent individuals, to prevent subsequent offenses, but there has to be some room for mercy. When someone violates traffic rules and receives a citation, we don't deny them a license for life. We allow them to pay a fee, take a class, and drive again. The American justice system values some lives more than others. Police officers are held in such high esteem that their deaths nearly always result in a DBI sentence. Why do manslaughter, self-defense, and even third-degree murder fall out of consideration when the victim is wearing a blue uniform? Yet, officers who kill are put on death duty and rarely prosecuted. The whole world rioted for justice for George Floyd, and Derek Chauvin still avoided a DBI sentence with his lengthy record of police misconduct. Because he took an oath to protect and serve, he will have a chance to be paroled, even though he knelt on a handcuffed man's neck for over 8 minutes. Statistics show that people of color serving DBI sentences far outnumber their white counterparts with similar crimes. These discriminatory sentencing practices have gone on for far too long. No one deserves to die in prison who has made the effort to change for the better. I would implore the members of the United Nations to imagine becoming a shadow, a memory while still alive. I would ask them to imagine seeing an empty space in every family photo where they should have been. I would ask them, how many photo albums are enough? I've been missing. I've been missing from family celebrations for over 50 years. I've paid my debt to society with interest, and I want nothing more than to reunite with my loved one. That one's personal because I know her.
Val, that is so powerful. What does the complaint ask these special rapporteurs from the UN to do?
So the complaint asks the special rapporteurs to declare that DBI sentences are cruel, racially discriminatory, an arbitrary deprivation of liberty, and violate individuals' right to life, family life, dignity, liberty, disproportionately on the basis of race. Number two, that the United States should abolish all DBI sentences. Three, that the U.S. should adopt maximum sentencing laws to end the imposition of virtual life and other lengthy or indeterminate sentences. Four, that all prison sentences must include parole eligibility with a determinate number of years. And five, that those eligible for parole should be released at their eligibility date unless there is an evidence-based determination otherwise.
Is there a mass movement emerging both inside and outside of prison to challenge DBI and other inhumane sentencing practices?
So a mass movement has been building for decades, at least in Pennsylvania. I'm less knowledgeable about other states, but in Pennsylvania, the movement actually started in prisons by people who were serving life, and they came together, started fighting for their rights, and they connected with their families on the outside, and now it's expanded drastically beyond that. I think this letter and the coalition that came together to submit this letter shows the momentum that this movement is gaining. It's becoming a national movement, and it's entering the international discourse.
Val, how can people get involved with the campaign to end death by incarceration, and how can our listeners follow your work?
There are a lot of ways you can get involved. If you're in Pennsylvania and you're listening to this, Tuesday, September 20th at 1 p.m., there's a rally at the state capitol at 1 p.m. in Harrisburg, where our communities are coming together to call for legislators to pass bills that would ban death by incarceration. So you could find an organization in your state and get involved. You can connect with somebody who is serving death by incarceration and write to them, and they'll tell you a whole host of ways that you could get involved. You could learn about the sentencing laws in your state, and you can lobby your legislators to pass bills.
Well, Valerie Kabbala, thank you so much for your incredibly important work and for joining us today on Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate you giving this issue airtime. Thank you so much. It means a lot.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Waiting around the train station, waiting for that train to take me away from this lonesome town.
Every time we access the internet, we open the door for companies to track our behavior and our location. This information is gathered and sold by data brokers, but it's not just for the purpose of helping marketers send us targeted ads. Our movement data is also marketed to law enforcement agencies around the nation. State sheriffs, highway patrol, and local police can now trace millions of Americans' everyday movements, often dating back several years. One Virginia data broker contracts to sell telephone geolocation data to state and local law enforcement. That's according to an investigation by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF. EFF's staff technologist Bennett Cyphers led the investigation. He and his team found that Fog Data Science sells access to a database with information about where a person was at any point in time over the past several years. The surveillance is not limited to possible crime scenes. It includes homes, churches, workplaces, health clinics, places in which we have constitutionally protected expectations of privacy. Joining us to talk about the investigation and how it threatens our privacy is Bennett Cyphers. Bennett is a staff technologist on EFF's Tech Projects team. He focuses on consumer privacy, competition, and state legislation. And he also assists with the development of Privacy Badger, a browser add-on that stops advertisers and trackers from secretly tracking our movements. Bennett, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Bennett, how is our personal location data collected and handled before it falls into the hands of some law enforcement agencies?
That's a great question. So personal location data is collected by a bunch of different actors in a bunch of different ways. But the data that we reported on when we were researching Fog Data Science specifically comes from third-party apps that people install on their smartphones, on iOS or Android. So this is like, you know, you'll download a weather app or, you know, a concert venue app or a navigation app, and the app will ask for location permissions. And then either whenever you have the app open or for some apps, you know, when it's on in the background as well, the app will be able to use your phone's GPS radio to gather location data periodically, and then it will send that off either directly to a data broker, or it will package it up with requests for advertisements, and that data will trickle out to data brokers as well. So it's collected by apps. Usually they have like an ostensible reason for collecting it, but then they will either sell it or, you know, use it to sweeten their deal for advertisers and kind of two-time you. And that's how the data ends up in this sort of swirling ecosystem behind the scenes, which eventually ends up in the hands of cops.
What is Fog Data Service, and how did EFF learn about them and then obtain public records to uncover their relationship with government agencies?
So Fog Data's main service is a website web app called Fog Reveal, and you can actually see it yourself. It's on the public web, www.fogreveal.com, and you won't be able to do anything with it because you need a login, which Fog sells access to for around $9,000 a year, and it seems like they only sell it to law enforcement. And this service allows police or whoever else has access to it to sort of, you know, drag and draw boxes around specific areas for specific time windows and see all the devices that were reported in those areas at those times. And it also allows them to zoom in on specific devices and see, you know, everywhere that device has been over the past days, weeks, or months. So we first found out about this service, I don't want to say by accident. We started doing a kind of broad spectrum public records project about a year and a half ago, specifically looking for relationships between state and local governments and location data brokers. So this was, you know, back in early mid 2021. There had been some reporting on other companies, like there's one called Ventel and one called Battle Street, which were collecting and selling geolocation data to federal agencies, specifically ICE, Customs and Border Patrol, the U.S. Special Forces, the FBI. But as far as we knew, they weren't doing business with any smaller kind of like regular law enforcement, like the police that most people interact with every day. And so we wanted to see, one, whether these companies were doing business with, you know, the smaller time local police, or if not, whether anyone else was, you know, taking advantage of that market and selling this data, which we know is just kind of floating out there in the ecosystem, to, you know, either local police or other bodies of local government. So we started sending out dozens and dozens of FOIAs and, you know, local public records requests to cities, police departments, state police, state attorneys general, just asking for like any records they have about any relationships with geolocation data providers. And we got a lot of nothing for a while. And then eventually from the, I believe it was the North Dakota Attorney General, we got this one, you know, one like two-page brochure that mentioned this company called Fog Data Science, and it made some really fantastic claims, and we'd never heard of this company before. And so we were like, we might be onto something. And then we followed up and did specific targeted requests asking about Fog Data Science to a whole bunch of law enforcement agencies, and we got a lot of stuff back, and that was how the investigation went.
Bennett, for local police departments, what benefits do they claim that data location gives them?
I mean, so most of what we know is what Fog claims it gives them, because, you know, one of the defining features of Fog service is that police departments don't really talk about it in public, and neither does Fog. So there were a couple times where police departments, you know, went to a city council and said like, hey, we need funding for this service. It's called Fog Data Science. And then, you know, there's one in particular in Anaheim, California, where the local fusion center was asking for like $40,000 to buy several Fog licenses. And they went to a city council meeting, you know, a representative for the local sheriff's department, and a city council member kind of pushed back and was like, hey, you know, this sounds like surveillance. What's this for? You know, is this going to affect people's civil liberties? And the person who had raised the, you know, who had come there to talk about it just said like, I don't know. I can't tell you about it, but we need it. You know, maybe I can get someone else to talk about it later on. And, you know, just didn't really say anything about what it was. And then the city council voted 6-0 with one abstention to approve the purchase anyway. And that was kind of the only time we saw anything approaching like public accountability or having the merits of Fog debated in a public forum. Other than that, it was all behind the scenes, and we didn't see any of it until we got these, you know, internal emails and exchanges between Fog and police departments, or police departments and other police departments. But what Fog says is, you know, this will help you solve crimes faster. It helps you develop leads. They specifically market its ability to develop leads in cases with no suspects. So sort of a pessimistic or a sort of cynical view of that would be like fishing expeditions. Like, you know, when the police know something happened at a general place and time, but they don't know who was involved, they can kind of cast this wide net and see like, oh, well, maybe we got some devices that were in the area at that time that we can track down those devices and see what happens. That's sort of a typical use case, I think. But it's also useful for police because it allows them to reach back in time, you know, retroactively, like post hoc, when they have a suspected device and see, you know, everywhere that device might have been over weeks and months. And that kind of data, you know, in the olden days, just wouldn't be available at all. Like, police would have to do proactive surveillance. Nowadays, it's usually is available from, you know, cell site location information, which is the data that carriers like AT&T will collect from your phone just based on the ways that it pings cell towers. But it's only available with a warrant. And so Fog gives access to the same kind of, you know, very sensitive, very powerful data, but a few, you know, at least a few police departments and Fog itself seem to think that no warrant or legal process is necessary to access it.
Bennett, does FOG differ from other data brokers? And if so, in what way?
Yeah, so there are a few, there are a lot of data brokers that collect and sell location data from apps. A few of those we already knew sell it to government agencies, but those are, for the most part, federal government agencies, and a lot of them aren't directly involved with law enforcement. These are like immigration agencies and military agencies. FOG, as far as we know, is the only company that sells this data directly to state and local law enforcement.
Bennett, you referenced the fact that no search warrants are used in this process of providing data to law enforcement. Why should we be concerned about police having location data?
You know, I think, first of all, some police agencies do use search warrants. I just want to be clear. It's not every agency that we got records from wasn't using warrants. Like a couple in California seem to think that Cal ECPA, which is a privacy law specific to the state, did require them to get warrants, at least in some situations. But yeah, a lot of them seemed like they weren't getting warrants. I mean, we should be concerned because your location kind of implicates like every part of your life. You know, if someone knows where you are all the time, like they know almost everything else about you, like they'll know, you know, where you work, where you associate, where you worship, when and where you go to the doctor, you know, if you're seeking abortion care, if you're going to any kind of like specialized location in the world that indicates anything about you, you know, like it can implicate your sexuality, your political views, basically everything over a long enough period of time. And FOG does reveal data over extremely long periods of time. As we said, we saw a couple instances of, you know, in practice, police getting access to months and months of data with a single query about a single person. And so, you know, this is, again, it gives a very in-depth view into any given person's life. And then the flip side of that is it's, you know, it seems like this one license gives you access to data about everyone in the U.S. at least, and we're not really sure, but maybe about devices from other countries as well. And so this is like, you know, it's both extremely detailed and extremely broad. And so you can, you know, like you could draw a box around a protest and see every one of the devices that was seen at that protest, and then go deep into the lives of every single person who was observed at that protest. And you can do that in a matter of like 5 minutes. With just a handful of queries. And so it's just like, if there's anything that should be protected by the Fourth Amendment, if the Fourth Amendment does indeed protect people and not places or things, which is sort of the modern legal conception of it, then this data should be protected by the Fourth Amendment, because this is, you know, basically as much information as you can get about a single person with a single query.
We're speaking today with Electronic Frontier Foundation's Bennett Cyphers about how data brokers collect and sell our personal information to the police. Bennett, what limits, restrictions, and guiding policies exist about when and how police can lawfully access this so-called pattern of life information?
That's a great question, and we tried really hard to kind of answer this with our records requests, and unfortunately we got a lot of silence on this point for the most part. So there were a few police departments that did sort of proactively seek out warrants or other legal process before accessing FOG. So for example, a couple of agencies in California, I want to say like Chino and Fremont, had internal assessments where they thought that, you know, accessing this data without a warrant would violate Cal ECPA, which is the Electronic Communications Privacy Act in California, but that's a state law. But, you know, other agencies like Greensboro, North Carolina, for example, a decently large city police department, you know, a whistleblower named Davin Hall told us that they never got warrants, and they were, you know, the police council was convinced that you could access this data without a warrant. And FOG itself kind of demurred on this question. Like, there are a couple times where police departments would say like, hey, this data seems pretty sensitive. Do you think, you know, this is going to violate Carpenter v. U.S., which is a recent Supreme Court decision about location data or something like that? And FOG was like, well, We don't know, but some other police departments who use our product have said that they don't think it violates the Fourth Amendment. So, you know, why don't you go talk to them? And so it seems like they were sort of, if anything, hurting their clients in the direction of like, yeah, it's fine. And, you know, Fogg didn't require any kind of, as far as we can tell, any kind of, you know, specific reasoning for making specific requests or, you know, process beyond just like allowing one of the clients to type in or click and drag around whatever area they wanted to search. So, you know, Fogg just gave them free access. It was up to the departments to build up some kind of process around how they access that data. And it seems like a lot of them just didn't do that, or at least they didn't tell us about it.
Bennett, in your investigation, did you come across any examples of police having used Fogg-supplied information in ways that blatantly violate our Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures?
I mean, I think the whole product violates the Fourth Amendment. I think even with a warrant, the kinds of searches that Fogg can run are too broad to be legal under the Fourth Amendment, much like geofence warrants. And there's more information on EFF's website on that issue. But probably the most blatant thing was, as I said, in Greensboro, where Davin Hall told us, you know, they used this product for a couple years. They never got warrants when using it. He said he didn't really know how they used it because it wasn't him or his team that was accessing the data. But he said, you know, he knows that in the past, that same department has used other, you know, sort of data broker-based surveillance tools to surveil protests and concerts and big gatherings of people and access tons of data about people just because they happen to be a specific place and time. And sometimes that included, you know, protests against police violence. And so I think that whole situation was probably the most blatantly alarming. But like I said, there were other cases like in Missouri where we don't have any evidence that the police department ever got warrants to access the data. And there are these very casual back and forths where the Missouri State Highway Patrol would say like, hey, Fogg, we're investigating, you know, a crime that happened at this place. Can you send us, you know, can you help us out? And Fogg would send back like tens of thousands of data points implicating several different devices that might have been in that area, and just, you know, completely exposing the private lives of whoever owned those devices, you know, with seemingly no legal process and, you know, pretty thin justification.
Bennett, what do you suggest we do to curb abuses of geolocation data?
I think there's sort of two sides to this problem, and both of them should be addressed. One is the fact that police seem to think that they can access this data without a warrant. That absolutely, I mean, I don't think that's true right now. I don't think it would survive a constitutional challenge in the courts. But even if it did, it shouldn't. And so, you know, the legislature should make it absolutely clear that you cannot just buy data that would otherwise be protected by the Constitution. That's not how this works. But the other side is, you know, this data is out there already. It's being bought and sold by hundreds of private companies. Sometimes, you know, those end up selling it to government agencies as well, which is probably the scariest because, you know, it starts to implicate like the state's monopoly on violence and their ability to use this data to target enemies and that kind of thing. But this data should not be for sale at all. No one should be buying this. Hedge funds and, you know, repo agencies and whoever else should not have access to this data either. And so I think we need to cut it off at its source. We need like a real comprehensive privacy law in the US that says that you cannot buy and sell sensitive information about people. You cannot collect this information without a good reason, and you cannot use it for reasons beyond the pretense that you collected it under. So yeah, I think we're going to need to tackle this problem in more than one way.
Bennett, in our remaining minutes, can you tell us about EFF's privacy badger, what it is, how people can use it?
Sure, yeah. So Privacy Badger is our tracker blocking browser extension. So what it does is as you browse the web, many of the sites that you visit, unfortunately, have a lot of what are called third-party trackers on them. These might be related to ad code or just a way for, the website to make an extra buck off of its visitors. And, companies like Google and Facebook and Oracle that are sort of silently in the background of the sites that you visit, collecting information about you and assembling profiles, etc. So Privacy Badger is designed to automatically detect and block all requests that your browser would make to those third-party trackers. As a side effect, it blocks a lot of ads and just kind of makes your browsing experience a lot smoother.
Good to know, Bennett. How can listeners read the investigation report and follow your work?
So we wrote everything that we have so far up on our website, www.eff.org. We have an issue page about location data brokers that sort of collects all of this work. I can share a link with the hosts. And there is an excellent Associated Press report by Grant Burke and Jason Dearen, which has some pretty good quotes from, some of the police departments and people involved with FOG, where they explain their side of the story. And in my opinion, does not make them look any better. So I recommend reading that as well.
Bennett Cyphers, you're doing such important work at EFF. We want to thank you for that, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Even when the sun goes down in the evening, when the sun goes down, sure gets lonesome when your baby's not around.
when the sun goes down. Sugar's lonesome when your baby's not around, when the sun goes down. Thank you.